is intended for mature audiences.
Salmonella with Veritas News. Alabama patent trolls sued all cell phone companies today for patent infringement, claiming that even before cellular phones existed, Alabama had mobile phones. When asked if extortion is how Alabama rolls, one patent plaintiff said no. But that's how Alabama shakes. Baseball's most famous pitcher, Walter Johnson's former employer, Harry Sinclair, died. Sinclair is famous himself for starting the company Sinclair Paints. Sinclair once expressed surprise at his former employee's success in baseball. He said Walter Johnson could lay on an even coat of semi-gloss on any wall, but could never paint the corners. $50 billion so-called communications company announced today it would drop its bid for acquisition of Time Warner Cable. Comcast president said the FCC's and Justice Department's separate announcements that each would block the merger because it wouldn't help American consumers had nothing to do with his decision. At the press conference, holding a rifle vertically in his right hand and a Bible in his left, he said, "God told me to drop the plan." Neither Gar nor Wayne LaPierre would comment. The NRA's Charlton Heston has not returned our phone calls. Fast food, Popeye's Chicken Corporation, defended their actions surrounding the firing of a 31-year-old pregnant store manager in Gainesville, Texas, yesterday. The woman, already the mother of two, is seen in security video held at gunpoint and physically abused by an armed masked robber who forced her to empty the cash register. Popeye's corporate honchos fired the woman for keeping too much money in the register, which they say goes against the terms of her job responsibility as manager. Liberal activists say Popeye's firing of the young pregnant wife and mother proves corporations are indeed not persons. They claim Popeye's actions were heartless and real people have hearts. Popeye corporate executives counter that they are not heartless. They reminded reporters that they did make an offer to the manager to keep her job if and when she returned the $438 she allowed the robber to steal. Many feel that if the fired manager takes that offer from Popeye's, she'll be reversing her usual position of bending over backwards. Additionally, the thrust of generosity from Popeye's, the young woman would need lots of olive oil. Salmonella with Veritas News.
Do you take it in the
Jonathan Brackle from Comcast. We've read your comments and complaints, and we know that a lot of you are very nervous about our merger with Time Warner Cable. So I wanted to talk to you today and let you know that no matter what happens, we don't give a fuck about you. Whether you're calling in for a service appointment for your cable box or wondering why your favorite channel disappeared, we don't give a fuck. That's what makes us an industry leader in terrible customer service. We don't give a fuck because we don't have to. Look, Are you going to go to another cable service provider? Chances are we own whatever movie or network you're watching, so that's still money in our pocket. Of course, you could watch Netflix or Hulu. In fact, you should.
We own Hulu.
We also make Netflix pay us extra for streaming content, which means they'll probably pass those costs on to you. Bottom line,
fuck you!
From the people who answer our phones to the people who write our TV shows, we do not give a fuck. And we collect labor violations and lawsuits the way fat kids collect cookies. Seriously, Google it. They don't call us the Walmart of telecom because we smell like rats and pizza. They call us that because we don't give a fuck about you. I know a big merger like this can be confusing, but all you really need to know is this is who we give a fuck about, and this is who we don't give a fuck about. And you. So thank you for choosing Comcast. You don't have a choice. Hey, America, go fuck yourselves. Featuring host, writer, humorous, experiential mystic, raconteur, and parallel parking expert, Tom Savino. Now, here he is, Savino Veritas, Wine the Truth, Tom Savino.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Savino with Savino Veritas coming to you live from Burbank, California, land of fantasy and make-believe. And tonight we have a very special guest who is the author of God Reconsidered, Searching for Truths in the Battle Between Atheism and Religion. That's Scott S. Smith, and he's going to be joining us in just a moment. Here on Savino Veritas, coming to you from Burbank, California, coming to you from Lion's Den Studios. We are not soundproof, we're not foolproof, and we are 90-proof. We are coming to you again from Burbank, California, as we do every Thursday night. Good to be back again. Circumstances were such that I was not able to be with you last Thursday. And next Thursday, since I already, word came out of my mouth, next Thursday we'll be with Hollywood correspondent, the Veritas Hollywood correspondent, Zane Delgado, and we will also be with comedian Jeremy Long, and we'll be talking about Shawshank Redemption next Thursday. But let's get on to this Thursday, and let me introduce our guest. Our guest is Scott Smith, author of God Reconsidered and other books, which he could tell us about as we just talk tonight. Scott, are you with us? Hello, Scott.
I'm alive and well.
Scott is alive and well in an undisclosed location in somewhere. And this topic is very close to me. Atheism versus religion, and we will play some cuts from which we could respond, both of us. But I want to ask you, the book is God Reconsidered, Searching for Truth in the Battle Between Atheism and Religion. Now, you've written other books as well, is that right?
Yeah, my so-called day job is I'm a freelance journalist. I had over 1,300 articles published on much more worldly topics than this particular book. And in fact, my last book was a takeoff on the column that I contribute to Investor's Business Daily about, which is extraordinary people, real life lessons on what it takes to achieve success. So in my non-supernatural life, I write and about and interview people like Bill Gates and Lee Iacocca, Meg Whitman, and people like that, and kind of what can you learn from them to be successful in your own business. So this is quite a departure for me as far as the topic goes.
Oh, yes, it seems quite different than that supernatural things. But let's start off in the beginning chapters of your book. You actually have a warning, a forewarning of people, warning them that they should, if they might not be prepared for the message. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I know some people will probably think this is like that old Abbie Hoffman book, Steal This Book, you know. So if I warn people, maybe they think I'm actually trying to tempt them to buy the book. What I say, to quote Jesus, who seems to be very quotable, let those who have ears hear. And what I'm saying is 90% of the public, whatever their philosophical spiritual persuasion is, if they're comfortable with that, or if they really don't want to know anything beyond kind of their upbringing and what they're used to, their background culturally, then this is not a book for those people. This is aimed at maybe the 10% of the public that realizes that conventional wisdom across the spectrum from atheism to Buddhism, whatever it might be, really doesn't provide very satisfactory answers. They're searching for answers because of some tragedy in their life has caused them to question the kind of the pat answers that each side gives. And so what I'm saying is this. This is kind of a report using my investigative skills over the last 30 years to find the truth for myself, and I'm sharing this with the readers. And I really had no intention of writing this book. It was only because my prior book initially got rejected by publishers. I had some time on my hands, so I thought, well, what the hell? Why don't I write this book that'll probably never get published? And then it took me a year of fighting publishers to get this thing on Amazon. But GodReconsidered.com does have a sample chapter. I think there's another one on Amazon. So people can find out kind of what they're getting into by reading that, and don't say I didn't warn you.
Okay, now, I'm familiar, Scott, with an organization, I'm sure you are, if you have done this legwork and research on this subject, called IONS. Are you familiar with that organization?
No.
The Institute of Noetic Sciences. The Institute
Yes, yes, I have heard of them. This is the Silicon Valley Group?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I think possibly Dean Radin might have affiliated with them.
Oh, absolutely, yes. He was, I believe.
I am familiar with them. It's been a while since I read his book, but that did ring a bell, right?
Well, when I when I get into discussions with people about supernatural phenomena and so on, and I bring up IONS, they always, at least the people I speak to, always shoot it down as, oh, that's junk science, that's not real science. You know, and I even have given some people some 35, 40-page, you know, reports of how they, what they did, and it doesn't seem, I guess people seem to just want to believe what they want to believe and not be open to anything.
Yeah, that's one of the points that I make right up front in the book is this notion that there are the religious people who are all irrational, and any belief in something we don't understand, maybe we'll call it paranormal or supernatural, is a bunch of superstition that the masses have not grown out of. And these people at places like the Skeptic Society in Pasadena and the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, which used to have a much more entertaining name with the acronym PSYCOP, which kind of told you where their heads were at. But these kind of people are as fanatically irrational, in my experience, as any fundamentalist in Alabama, just to pick a state. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is I got tired of their kind of arrogant attitude about things that they didn't really understand.
Yeah, that's... It's an interesting phenomenon that I've experienced myself. Again, when I talk about this subject, people use the term religiously. They are religiously.
Yeah, absolutely. They are zealous like you can't believe it. And let me give you the best example of that, because my wife used to know Michael Crichton at a time when he had just gotten divorced. He'd written Andromeda Strain, and he was already famous. He had gone to Harvard Medical School and graduated, and he was kind of at a point in his life where he needed to kind of take a break. So he went around the world and had some very, very strange experiences. He came back, and he began writing his book, Travels. Now, in the back of the book, in the appendix, he has a very amusing thing pertinent to our discussion, which is this. You know, the Skeptic Society thought, oh, here's a famous science fiction writer, Harvard medical graduate. Let's invite him over to talk. Well, they got word of what he was going to talk about, which was, you know something, all that materialistic analysis of reality doesn't really work, because he was going to tell them about some very strange experiences that could only be called supernatural. As soon as they found out that he was a heretic, they decided to disinvite him. So he got his revenge, because the book Travels has this appendix with the whole speech that he was going to deliver to them, trying to disabuse them of the notion that they've got reality completely figured out, just like a century before the physicists thought they had all the answers, except they just had to work out that thing with the ether.
Well, that's very interesting anecdote about, yeah. We're talking with Scott Smith, author of God Reconsidered. You're listening to Savino Veritas on SRN 1 live. And also, if you're not listening at the moment, you'd have to be listening at the moment. But the moment might not be this moment. You could listen to the archive shows at juicedtalk.com. Now, Scott, let's talk about some of the evidence for ESP. I came across documents with ions, but what have you found?
Right, I got interested in this maybe 15 years ago when Dean Radin, who was a classically trained and skeptical Bell Labs engineer, and he had heard that some of the people in the lab said that they had a black thumb, that if they got near machines, you know, they would malfunction and stuff. And curiosity was piqued. And that ultimately led him to doing lots of double-blind experiments on extrasensory perception, or telepathy, as some people call it. Now, this is a guy who was definitely not a new age, wanna believe in this stuff type of guy. He was very hard-headed. And he went to Stanford Research Institute, SRI, up in the Silicon Valley, and he was astounded to find out, once he had been sworn in as a classified scientist, that the Russians and others were very, very advanced in studying things like ESP. And so he had to start taking a more open mind about it. And what he did is he wrote ultimately a book called The Conscious Universe. It is a spectacularly, rationally argued book, which fundamentally, at its core, is on the question of whether ESP exists. And what he shows is that there have been so many double-blind experiments around the world over the decades on this, that it isn't even a question that needs investigation. Now what these scientists are interested in is the application. Well, this is such bad news for the likes of the Skeptic Society and the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. Here's how they handled this. And I was kind of curious to see, you know, what how this would be greeted because he was one of their own, like Crichton. Well, Michael Shermer at the Skeptic Society is very clever, and he wrote a dismissive review of the book that basically said, well, you know, these are the usual arguments, and it's kind of the best of breed, but you can't take it seriously. The Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, which publishes the Skeptical Inquirer, would not review it at all. But worse than that, no major publication would review the book, and you might wonder why. Well, the answer is very simple. The science advisors, particularly for books at the major magazines, are very much like the medical boards in California and other states where the tail wags the dog. The fanatics who do not want heresy, you know, to get into universities or into magazines and so forth, they're the ones that make sure everybody toes the line. Thomas Kuhn, many years ago, wrote a classic book The Cycles of the Structure of Scientific Revolution, and which basically said that conventional wisdom and its protectors will initially denounce a heresy. Then, after a couple of decades, they'll tolerate it as, well, it's just another point of view. And eventually, the Inquisition types die off, and eventually, the heresy becomes conventional wisdom. And so the scientific gatekeepers would not review it, with the exception of Nature in Britain, and they did a hatchet job, to the point that one Nobel Prize winner wanted to write a letter to be published in Nature pointing out the flaws in the review. They would not publish the letter. Now, all of this is to say that this book is the definitive book on the evidence for ESP, and the skeptics could not handle it and would not give it the light of day. Now, the funny thing about it is, who says ESP has to be supernatural? Why can't it just be part of nature? And Sigmund Freud, famously an atheist, thought so. He said, I've had so many telepathy experiences with my patients, I know it exists. The problem with today's militant skeptics is they've confused atheism, which is their religion, with a disbelief in all things that might be supernatural. The two are not the same. You could be an atheist and still believe in ESP, but the Church of the Skeptics won't allow it. That's the essence of it.
It's really remarkable how the obstacles, even people with, as you said, with great reputations and that try to point out the problems in the rejection of the science, the rejection of even looking at the science, it's just like another religion. It's another dogma that can't be broken or somehow.
It's like a cult, you know.
Yeah. It's it's just remarkable. I know that speaking of another psychologist, Jung, and personally have some experiences with synchronicity that have really been major influences in my life and kind of have guided me. It guided me in the sense of what I believe, and I know a lot of people just won't accept those kinds of things. In your book, there is some part of the book about UFOs, and could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this for me is a particularly interesting subject for a couple of reasons. When I got interested in this in the late 1980s, I knew absolutely nothing about it, and I was just looking for a fun subject just to get informed, nothing too heavy, and I figured that it would be something that would be a mystery. It might be like the JFK assassination, where no matter how much you read or study, you can't come to a firm conclusion, and I just thought, oh, well, why don't I find out what all the little green men are and all that kind of thing, and I thought it was going to be fun. Well, first of all, there's a great book out by C.D.B. Bryan, a journalist I've interviewed. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, called Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind. And he came to the same conclusion I did, and this guy's an even more credible journalist than I in terms of worldly and investigative journalism. And that is this, that whatever the UFO business is, there are two things you can say definitely about it. The first is that it's probably more than one phenomenon. You know, maybe it's some real aliens and something supernatural and a bunch of people who are confused and so forth. But the abduction aspect of it is so spooky that Brian and I got out of the study of UFOs because you end up in a hall of mirrors where you end up really questioning your sanity, because it's very weirder and disturbing than you can possibly imagine. So I tell people up front, do not study the abduction phenomenon because you are not going to really understand it. Now, my wife and I have interviewed scientists and medical doctors who have removed very strange materials that were implanted in people who claimed to be abducted, just to give you one example of the weirdness. Now,
really?
I said there were, yeah,
wow.
I could give you names, and I've mentioned one guy in one of my articles and stuff like that, and they don't really hide this from the public. Of course, they're considered crazy by fellow scientists, but that aspect is a very, very strange thing. Now, here's what I go into in God Reconsidered. I have a chapter on this, and which actually draws on a whole book I wrote, which was never published, and I co-authored this with the famous Israeli psychic Uri Geller.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and if you read, you know, James Randi and some of these other guys, you know, Geller has been disproven and so forth. I know otherwise, and I could tell you stories to make my point. But I did read all the skeptical books before I first interviewed Geller, and we got to know each other. So he and I wrote this book for a variety of reasons. It didn't see the light of day. But what I did is I set out in that unpublished book, which I've adapted to this chapter in God Reconsidered, I set out to find out if, in fact, there were indisputable hard evidence for UFOs. Forget about the abduction thing. Could you prove from radar evidence, from trained observers like pilots, from physical evidence on the ground and other things, are there incidences that are pretty darn hard to refute? Well, it turned out, as I explain in these chapters, I give three examples. Here's the fascinating thing about it. Not only is there incontrovertible evidence that something has been visiting us, a lot of the top scientists who were tasked by the Air Force to explain these away ended up deciding that, in fact, they didn't have a very good explanation, and they jumped ship and formed groups to investigate this phenomenon objectively. So I got intrigued, and I looked into a bunch of sample cases, and here's what I found. I found in every single case that the so-called skeptics could not stick to the facts to make their case. If you read their book, you would believe that these sober scientists had looked into this silly phenomenon, and it was easy to explain away. Now, what I did was I read what they said, and then I went back to the original documents, and in every single case, the designated hitters for the skeptics lied through their teeth. They knew they were lying, twisting the facts, changing the facts of the case in order to make the case that there could not possibly be a legitimate UFO phenomenon. And that speaks for itself. If they can't make an honest case, and they know they're not making an honest case, then, wow, this must be a very strange phenomenon worth investigating.
Yes, I've recently seen interviews on the film of some Air Force people who have no longer in the Air Force and have now come forward and said, you know, we were told to say things or told not to say things. And we're coming forward, and this is not exactly the way it happened, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very strange thing. The most famous heretic or traitor to the conventional wisdom was J. Allen Hynek, a Northwestern University astronomer, and he was in charge of Project Blue Book, and he made up the phrase swamp gas is one of the explanations of lights that people saw and they got confused and so forth. And he and his assistant eventually decided, you know something, we can't explain this stuff. And the funny thing is, the Michael Shermers of the world and the Committee for the Skeptical Inquiry, of course, they themselves have never investigated these things. They've never gone to the original sources like I did, because they have faith in their bishop. And their bishop, in each case, happens to be their designated expert on whatever the topic is, you know, alternative medicine, which, you know, they're very hostile towards, or UFOs or whatever it happens to be. They don't do the research themselves, but they're great talkers.
That's you got to stick to the party line and what you're told, and until you have an opportunity to say what's going on. There is a part here. Let me ask you, Scott, because you mentioned your wife a couple of times,
yeah.
And it sounds like you and your wife are pretty much agreed on a lot of this stuff. Would that be?
That's a very interesting question, because at the time I met her in 1974, I was married then, and there was a subsequent marriage, and for the next, probably 17 years or so, she and I were just platonic friends, and I had had some experiences that you can classify as paranormal, and also, as a journalist, I'd started to interview some really interesting people who I trusted, who had some very spooky experiences. And so when I first met her, she told me, you know, I've dabbled in magic, the real thing. And that caught my attention. And I said, in all seriousness, I'd like to see your library. This wasn't a come-on, but I knew I could tell the real thing from the new agey type of, oh, I'm a witch type person, you know, that these people read something in a book and they think they know how to contact the spirits or whatever it is. So shortly after I got to know her initially, she was not trying to impress me, because we had no real interest in each other at that time in the late 70s, but or mid 70s, but she came to me one day and said, listen, I just had the scariest experience of my life. And I said, what happened? And I'm going to withhold all the details, but I will say this. Maybe she'll come on another time on a show and talk about this herself, but what impressed me was that she was scared to death. And this is a person who has had a very remarkable life in many ways, and she's had near-death experiences and, you know, her own supernatural stuff. But she said that this teacher, somebody who I got to know, who was very well known in the supernatural field, he basically did a spell. This was at a time she wasn't taking him seriously. He said, can I come over and do a little spell? And she said, sure, go ahead. She wasn't taking him seriously. So she was kind of passively there while he wanted to do his little thing. And she figured it would be like the normal thing. And what she basically said is that they entered an alternate reality, that the entire room changed. And the hair on the back of her head was sticking out. It was so scary what happened, the energy in the room. And this was one of the very few guys who from an early age had a natural talent at this kind of stuff of contacting spirits. So sometime we may go into that further, but let's just say she's one of a number of people that I have known that I believe, you know, has that gift of reaching into the other world. And at one point I actually challenged Michael Shermer. I said, hey, listen, why don't we have a Halloween party for you skeptics, and we'll bring along a few of the people that we claim are the real psychics and mediums, and let's have some fun and see if we can't stir up some trouble. And he didn't take me up on that for some reason.
Well, that is a great story, and I appreciate. I'm glad I heard that story, because sometimes I feel alone because of my experiences. And my wife is we share many things, but this area is not one of them for sure. She is hardcore, you know, I have to have the facts, and I've got to have this, and so on and so forth. I'll give you a quick story, if I may. By the way, you're listening to Sabino Veritas on SRN1, and I'm talking with Scott Smith, author of God Reconsidered. We're talking about his book, God Reconsidered. But Scott, back in the 70s also, I was going through a divorce. And I was a writer, and I was here in California, but I'm from New York. And I was writing things here, and I had a producer was interested in some idea that I had. He wanted me to go back to New York and get letters of intent from the governor's office of film and the mayor's office of film and so on and so forth. So I did go back to New York, but I was in the middle of this divorce. And it was actually, I was staying at my parents' house at the time, and I called the governor's office of film, and this woman answered, and I told her my idea for the show, and she said, oh, that sounds really interesting. I think we won't have any problem with getting your letter of intent. Anyway, we got into a conversation, she and I, on the phone. And in the middle of the conversation, she starts telling me about personal things that she couldn't possibly have known. I didn't say anything to her. And in fact, the last thing she said to me before we hung up was, don't worry, everything's going to be all right. And I said, with what? And she said, you're divorced. You know. It turns out, and again, this is a long story, I'm going to cut to the chase of the story here. She intrigued me, it turns out that she was a witch. I said, how did you know these things? I want to know these things. And I went to meet her at her place a few days later, and I said, I want to know more about this. So I go into her apartment in Brooklyn, and she has a rabbit hopping around the apartment. I said, that's nice, but it's a bit unusual. You know, people. And she said, that's my familiar. And she started telling me about witchcraft and how she's in witchcraft. That evening, about three times that evening, she channeled. I didn't know what it was then, but she later told me it was channeling. And when she channeled, her face totally changed. Her face totally changed. Just like your wife was talking about how the room changed. Her face just changed. It just was like really round. And then when she wasn't channeling, it just went back to, I didn't want to say normal or whatever. Anyway, I said, I'm not a witch, and how do I get, I'd like to know about this stuff. She said, when you go back to Los Angeles, I want you to look up this organization called Silva Mind Control, Silva, S-I-L-V-A, Silva Mind Control, and I want you to take their course and learn stuff. And as it turns out, and when I got back to Los Angeles, they here at the Holiday Inn in Van Nuys, they were having, that week, the next week when I came back, they were having a whole week of training. I took the week of training and learned many things, scanning, had unbelievable experiences of knowing that things that I would never believe I would know, you know. Anyway, the last day of the training, the facilitators guide us to get a male counselor and a female counselor. We develop a laboratory in our brain, in our mind, and we can always go to this laboratory to solve problems, and we have a male counselor and a female counselor. And to get the male counselor, you don't, like, pre-think, well, I want so-and-so to be my male counselor. You just go into this trance state and visualize a curtain, and the curtain opens up, and behind the curtain is your male counselor. And then we do the same thing for the female counselor. And lo and behold, I open up the curtain, and behind the curtain is this woman. Her name is Randy. And she was a witch. She was my female counselor. She was behind the curtain. She had told me previously, she said, right after the last training, I want you to call me immediately to talk about what happened. And as soon as I got out, I got into a payphone, called her. She wasn't home. She had an answering machine on and said, so-and-so, this is Randy, et cetera, et cetera. She said, if this is Tom from Los Angeles, I want you to know that you don't need to call me anymore because you could always talk to me in your laboratory. And that was the beginning of my spiritual trip, because it led to many more things. But you mentioned I would love sometime to talk to you, you and your wife, maybe be on the show. But let's go to other parts of your book. What is it? At 9 o'clock or 9 o'clock Pacific time, we have to break away for news from Canada. But before we do that, let's talk about this is interesting, near-death experiences. And I have heard, and many people have seen, I think, documentaries of people have had near-death experiences where they have left their bodies and maybe in surgery or something like that, and have known things like from the, not even in the room that their body was in, but in other rooms that they couldn't possibly know. But let's talk about that, because I know the skeptics and people totally, you know, say, oh, that they're having some sort of brain phenomena. That they, well, what do you think about that?
Yeah, and incidentally, one reason why I think my wife is quite psychic, and she can touch people and tell them where they're stuck in their lives, and I've seen her do that many times, but she had two near-death experiences, and there is plenty of evidence that people who go through that are most likely to have a big increase in psychic abilities. There's a very good book out by Michael Schmicker called Best Evidence, and the biological and pharmaceutical factors that a lot of the skeptics will cite to try to say, oh, it's just, the brain biochemistry at death or something like that. I just really can't understand why the skeptics can't stick to the hard evidence, because when you drill into their arguments, they sound very persuasive when people like Shermer and others get onto TV, and in their 30-second soundbite, they say, oh, this has long ago been explained by real scientists and so forth. The reality, as you said, is that there are plenty of things that cannot be explained away. People who are in another building, another city, whatever it is, the individual spirit leaves the room and can report back conversations, which, if they were willing to grant ESP, then you can say, well, you know, that is just a case of ESP, but of course they reject that. There is an amazing consistency across religions and cultures on the basic stages when people die and come back. This is not real death, but the consistency of what they report is interesting. And yes, it is influenced by culture. Let's say you get on the other side, maybe you'll see Krishna. If you're a Christian, maybe you'll see Jesus. But the basic steps that people go through when this happens are consistent. And when you look at the arguments of the skeptics that try to say, oh, there's no life after death, you know, this can all be explained away, the fact that they have to resort to these phony arguments just goes to show you how nervous they are about this stuff. Now, at the very end of that particular chapter, as I kind of work through the different types of experiences and Incidentally, Scott Roga, the parapsychologist I interviewed in 1990, who was the best, most objective kind of scientific analyst of paranormal phenomena I've ever met, and I interviewed him on Father's Day in 1990, and he was murdered a few weeks later, and this was like the only really in-depth interview he ever gave. But one of the things we talked about was the fact that he had learned to leave his body at will, and he could, one time when he was in New York, he came back to see what was going on at his house, and his roommate had brought over a guest, and they had an arrangement. There was not supposed to be anybody over there, and he confirmed this when he came back. So I mention that because aside from near-death experiences, there are many, many, many other quite credible examples of ghosts, of evidence for the spirit. If there is one thing that I can say for sure that I've learned in my 30 years of looking into every religion there is and traveling the world and talking with shamans and so forth, it's that there is a spirit, and when we die, it transcends death. Now, what happens after that? I think most religions are a case of the blind men feeling the elephant. They all have a little bit of the truth. None of them have the story right, which is why they contradict each other. And but that we survive, there's really no serious debate about that.
Well, you know, I want to get into that subject as well right now, as a matter of fact. Well, it's a perfect time since you brought it up. And that is... The one thing I was looking at about your book is you're not you're a little skeptical yourself, or you're not into, you don't kind of devalue the idea of reincarnation, and I was wondering if you could speak on that a little bit, because let's hear what you have to say about that.
This is one of the things that will make my book unpopular, because it's easy to attack or debunk and find fault with the monotheistic religions, but people want to think the East has the answers. And the deeper I looked, the more I became convinced that they were at least as wrong as Western religions. Now, first of all, I will say that maybe reincarnation exists in some cases where there is an attachment to this physical life and people are drawn back to it. But the evidence that is offered for reincarnation doesn't stand up at all. Scott Rogo wrote a book called The Search for Yesterday, in which he demolishes all the popular evidence for reincarnation, first of all. The second problem I have with it is that it doesn't really solve everything. People say, oh, well, you know, you happen to date these kind of girls because of what happened in your prior life. That doesn't give you a cause. That just pushes it back to another life. So how did you get that interest to begin with? Because, you know, saying that reincarnation explains things in this life is not a very effective explanation of ultimate causes. And more importantly, it's the naivete of Americans who think that, you know, maybe they weren't born, you know, in a past life, they weren't Cleopatra or King Arthur, but somehow they weren't a kid who was starving in Africa and died at three. Americans are very, very naive about world history and the fact that up until very recently, the infant mortality rate was 50%. And, you know, the Black Death killed about a third of Europe and so forth. The notion that we can be born into another life so that we can make spiritual progress, that's the theory behind reincarnation. The problem is, anybody who has done any study of psychology, and I, just for the record, I've been through 8 years of psychotherapy, so I know something about this, Harville Hendrix, Oprah's favorite marriage counselor, has a book called Getting the Love You Want. And what he basically shows in the first third of the books is that we are all screwed up in the first months and years of our lives, way beyond our conscious mind. We get programmed so that if you are reborn into another family, you're just going to have a whole new set of dysfunctions. Anybody who thinks rebirth allows you to blossom in this steady progress from life to life until enlightenment really is not familiar with human nature, human history. And incidentally, I've been to India, I've been to Sarnath, where the Buddha gave his enlightenment speech, I've talked to Hindus, I'm very fond of some branches of Hinduism, I know the Hare Krishna people very well and so forth, and I'm quite fluent in Hindu philosophy and Buddhist philosophy, but the notion that reincarnation, that there's lots of evidence for it, and that this is, you know, the magic wand that will solve all the mysteries of life, is just completely naive.
I disagree with you on that topic. However, I don't have concrete evidence. I only have my own experience, and I believe, if you want to say that, or it's my perspective based on my experience, that, I fall in that school that believes, we're here to learn what we didn't before, and to, in fact, do that with the same people we were with before until a certain point, so that you would, be still, you would have this life with the same souls that you had in the last life and the life before, but different roles, of course, different roles, different genders, and so on and so forth. But anyway, that is...
Well, let me amend what I said. I gave a fair warning in the beginning of the book and so forth that, people should be careful about reading my book. And I do say that, first of all, the particular philosophy that I ended up picking, there are many people who believe in reincarnation. There's no big dogma about it. And so if people want to believe that, that's fine. And they should not read the chapter in my book on Hinduism, because that's where I address it. Just so that people understand, Buddhism does not believe in reincarnation. People have a misconception of that. Buddhism does not believe in a soul. If you don't have a soul, you can't reincarnate. But as far as Hinduism goes, I really admire Hinduism in a lot of ways. The reincarnation part, not really, but it's a very naturalistic, shamanistic philosophy that has much to commend it. And if people find that reincarnation works for them, that's great. People don't have to agree with me on everything, surprisingly enough.
Well, that's interesting. Just coincidentally, that right now in my life, I'm discovering Paramahansa Yogananda, and it's interesting because I was reading a book by a Catholic monk who had difficulty accepting teachings of Yogananda, the teachings of Kriya Yoga, and how to quickly develop your consciousness. And because he was Catholic, he wondered, I'm not supposed to do this again, because you have to agree with the party line. But he was told by monks older than he that by all means, anything that will develop, the Kriya Yoga you should do it. It's not antithetical to believing in Christ or anything like that. And then, ironically, the Yogananda is here in the West, was very supportive and promoting of Christianity and to practice his practices in terms of whatever religion you were. involved with, especially Christianity. And I'm finding actually my personal path is really interesting in the, for me, in the fact that I see how things connect a lot. And if you get past all the bullshit, if you get past all the dogma, a lot of these practices, a lot of the practices are similar and will lead you to a certain state of consciousness. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, I would say that what I recommend to people who are just getting into all this is you should start with meditation, and it doesn't matter what kind it is, because what I found is synchronicities increase dramatically. You start magnetizing your environment. All kinds of weird so-called coincidences happen. Your psychic abilities will open up. You will meet people where, you know, there's some kind of important business to be done and stuff like that. So any spiritual practice, whether it's the Muslim prayer or whether it's the prayer to the Virgin Mary or any kind of spiritual ritual, meditation, so forth, will increase the miracles in your life.
We concur on that issue. You're listening to Savino Veritas with Scott Smith, author of God Reconsidered. And let's see, do we have time? Let's listen to a little bit of this cut. Let's listen to Russell. This is Russell Brand. Russell Brand from his little thing called Shrews News, but it's about atheism and God. So let's listen to it, and we'll comment on it as we come back.
Hello, I'm Russell Brand. This is The Truths. Do subscribe here. Now, Stephen Fry has got to be one of the most beloved people in this country, if not the entire world. He's made us think about depression, homosexuality, cleverness in a different way. He's General Melchett from Blackadder, for God's sake. He's one of the most beloved figures in our cultural pantheon, and he's clever as all hell. And here I am about to get into a debate, if not an argument, with him, because Stephen Fry really, really aggressively doesn't believe in God, and I really, really do believe in God. He went on a TV show to talk about atheism and God. Let's have a look at it now.
Suppose it's all true, and you walk up to the pearly gates, and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically, what's known as the Odyssey, I think, I'll say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac. Utter maniac. Yes, the world is very splendid, but it also has in it insects whose whole life cycle is to burrow into the eyes of children and make them blind. They eat outwards from the eyes. Why? Why did you do that to us? It's perfectly apparent that he is monstrous, utterly monstrous, and deserves no respect whatsoever. The moment you banish him, your life becomes simpler, purer, cleaner, more worth living in my opinion.
In a way, what Fry is talking about, in my opinion, is literalism, a literal interpretation of doctrine. In this case, because it's an Irish Catholic interviewer, Gabe Byrne, he's talking about a literal translation of the Gospels. And other than like mentioning some phenomena in nature, like burrowing insects and that, talking entirely about human behaviour and human value systems. Now, Joseph Campbell, the cultural mythologist, said all religions are true in that the metaphor is true. So what Campbell's saying there is that religion is an attempt to explain the unknowable, in the same way that science is an attempt to explain the unknowable. Science can explain the mechanics of the universe and can explain the mechanics of biology and anatomy, but can it ever explain the why? The answer is no. No, it can never explain why this is happening. What we all want to know is there a reason for us being here? And what is the nature of the universe? What is the nature of our consciousness?
We're going to pause there for a minute, and we'll comment on that, if you would, Scott, when we come back from the news which we are going to go to in just a minute. Especially, Scott, I would like to talk about that. The image of atheists, a lot of atheists have this God thing. How could there be a God when there's such misery in the world? And maybe we'll talk about that, okay?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to break for the news now with Phil Hong in Canada. Phil, take it away.
A man is dead after a collision with a Viva bus on Yonge Street. Police say the crash happened during Thursday morning rush hour and that the victim was the driver of a truck. A petition is circulating over an old grain elevator in Stouffville. Metrolinx is planning to use the site for extra parking spaces at the nearby GO station. And Newmarket's property tax is set to rise. Town Council approved this year's operating capital budgets, which includes a 3.5% hike. More seasonable, Pearson 13, North 13. This update is brought to you by Frank Atolo, 148.ca. Twitter, worth retweeting. Frank replies at 148.ca/Frank. I'm Philip Hong from SRN National News. Now back to Tom Savino, the CEO of Veritas, and SRN.
Thank you, Phil, for that report from Canada. And we're coming to you. This is Savino Veritas from Burbank, California, where it's a lot warmer than Phil's area of Canada there, where the SRN1 studios are. And through some supernatural way that I don't understand, digitally supernatural, we're coming to you through Canada from Burbank. I don't know how that works, but it does. Maybe that's a good metaphor for the show tonight. But we're talking with Scott Smith, author of God Reconsidered, the searching for the truth and the battle between atheism and religion. And we listened there, Scott, to a little bit of the Russell Brand thing. Now, what's your take on that? Because atheists, they're always talking about how could there possibly be a God because there's such misery, and what kind of God is that? What do you have to say about that?
Okay, so I'm a heretic for both camps. I actually agree with Stephen Fry that the God of this world, the creator of this world, is a monster. Now, why do I say that? Well, I happen to be a Gnostic Christian, and the Gnostics distinguish between the creator God and the ultimate God. So that's a whole subject unto itself. But I think the atheist analysis of the dilemma of our life, where there is so much suffering, as I said before, throughout not just human history, but going back hundreds of millions of years, it's not a subject that people can get their heads around, which will make the center part of my book, after I demolish the atheist arguments in the first three, the next three chapters discuss, is there evidence of intelligent design, higher intelligence, that sort of thing? And what I say is, it's quite frankly a mixed bag. The atheists have some weaknesses. The true believers have their problems. But another chapter drills into the question that nobody wants to think about, which is the evidence show that there is a benevolent creator God. Now, that has nothing to do with the existence of a God per se, but these two chapters are going to be very tough for people to deal with, and it took me a long, long time to understand that. And then the third section there is about free will and whether we have been created to even have much free will. And what I say is it's quite limited, but it's not non-existent. So I actually agree with Stephen Fry in terms of his caustic analysis of the human dilemma. The problem is not that there's anything wrong with atheism per se if it weren't so narrow-minded, zealous, and militant. It's that they carry it too far. They then say that because there's a lot of suffering in the world, there can't be any supernatural dimension. One thing doesn't have to do with the other, but modern atheism is a religion, just like the Southern Baptist, and you can't really talk any sense into them beyond that.
Yes, indeed. I totally agree with that. We're talking with Scott Smith. Scott Smith, an author of God Reconsidered. And we are, you mentioned the Gnostic, did you consider yourself a Gnostic Christian? correct? I'm curious. Right,
yeah, there's actually a church down in Atwater called Ecclesia Gnostica, and you can find it at gnosis.org, and that's GN, the Greek gnosis, meaning insight or spiritual knowledge, essentially. LA is one of the few places that actually has a full-time church devoted to this.
Now, I read the Gospel of Thomas,
mm-hmm.
and also of Mary Magdalene.
Right, right.
Are these some of the documents that you in your church there study or discuss?
Yes. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, you're probably familiar with the Great Courses, also known as the Teaching Company. And they have these CDs and audiovisual programs. A couple of months ago, they came out with one on Gnosticism in its broadest sense. And it basically was a phenomenon that emerged shortly after Christ died. And it was one of the contenders to become mainstream Christianity. And I discussed this at the end of the book, but basically it's known for its kind of, you might say, the Taoist-like Gospel of Thomas, a more of a liberal, mystical, tolerant, and less literalist type of Christianity. So Russell Brand would probably be actually rather comfortable with it. It tends to have more of a feminist element. Mary Magdalene is elevated in many of the Gnostic Gospels. It became somewhat infamous because Dan Brown's novels played around in the Gnostic area with many of the things that Gnostic Christians believe. But in essence, one of the things they say is that conventional Christianity, literalist Christianity, the Christianity that I grew up on, the so-called synoptic gospels, the story of Jesus and so forth, the closer you look at it, the less it makes sense. And Bart Ehrman, Ehrman, who's a great biblical scholar, used to be a fundamentalist, and he wrote a book called Jesus Interrupted, and what he basically shows is that the Synoptic Gospels, never mind the Gospel of John, which is off on its own path, that the Synoptic Gospels are not in harmony. If the New Testament cannot get the basic facts of Jesus' life right, then what about the dogma? Well, the answer is simple. The dogma that reigns today in Christianity was made up centuries later. The church got together, the Catholic Church initially, and voted on what they should believe. And if you go compare things like the Trinity with the New Testament, you can't find these things. I mean, the what Jesus taught and what the churches teach today are very different. That's the essence of it.
Yeah, well, that's what you were talking about is kind of connects or fits with what my own research has been, and that it seems to have been like a political thing of to disregard the Gospels of Thomas and Mary Magdalene, and those Gospels, especially Mary Magdalene, had a lot of spiritual techniques, things, and ideas that apparently some of the other apostles were not too happy with Jesus for giving to Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, I go into some detail. If people are interested in the book, it's GodReconsidered.com. And the thing about Gnosticism and Gnostic Christianity is it's not dogmatic. People are allowed to disagree without being hauled before the Inquisition. I just got through writing an article for Investor's Business Daily on Galileo, so I've been thinking a lot about the Inquisition lately. But yes, it's absolutely incredible when you go back into the early history of Christianity and how much of it wasn't just political. But, you know, they said, hey, now we're in charge. We have the power. I guess that means we can put our enemies in the church out of business. And so they went around persecuting other Christians, and, you know, it's a very, very dark thing. In fact, The only crusade against fellow Christians was to exterminate the medieval Cathars, who were Gnostics, in France. They killed a million of them. And you never hear that discussed when we talk about the church's dirty laundry. It's very disgraceful. And fortunately today, we can, you know, believe things that were once heresy and we would have been burned at the stake for. I also just recently wrote about Joan of Arc. I guess it's on my mind right now. So,
well, you know what the Buddha said, from what I, from my research of him, that this is what I've come to learn. This is what I've experienced. But don't believe me. Don't believe me. In fact, some scholars say he would be appalled that there would be an ism after his for him in honor of him, or, you know, about his teachings, because he's kind of espoused that you have to, you know, I could recommend these things, but you have to experience it. Don't just listen to what I say.
Yeah, it's worse than that. I have a chapter on the rise of Mahayana Buddhism, and again, this is something I've researched quite intently. There's very little relationship between modern Buddhism and what the Buddha taught. All you have to do, if you believe that the words that were in the initial scriptures were accurately recorded, I admire the Buddha for one thing. I actually disagree with him on a number of philosophical issues, but I admire him because, as you said, he was very careful to make claims metaphysically. He said, look it, I'm not 100% sure about, you know, all this afterlife stuff and other speculation. You know, you guys got to have your own experiences, come to your own conclusions, and don't take my word for things. He was very conservative about that, and I think that was admirable, and unfortunately, Buddhists are the last ones to follow what the Buddha said.
That is a profound statement. It's on tape. I was just going to write it down, but I'm taping this. That's great. That's great.
It's a chapter on Buddhism, so there is in there.
Yeah, that is really great. We're going to break for a minute, Scott and everyone, to listen to George Carlin, who is talking mostly about the Christian God, but God, all gods. And let's hear this, and we could respond to it.
Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish, where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time.
But he loves you.
He loves you, and he needs money. He always needs money. He's all-powerful, all-perfect, all-knowing, and all-wise. Somehow, just can't handle money. Religion takes in billions of dollars, they pay no taxes, and they always need a little more. Now, you talk about a good bullshit story. Holy shit.
Thank you very much. But I want you to know something. This is sincere. I want you to know, when it comes to believing in God, I really tried. I really, really tried. I tried to believe that there is a God who created each of us in his own image and likeness, loves us very much, and keeps a close eye on things. I really tried to believe that, but I got to tell you, the longer you live, the more you look around, the more you realize something is fucked up. Something is wrong here. War, disease, death, destruction, hunger, filth, poverty, torture, crime, corruption, and the ice capades. Something is definitely wrong. This is not good work. If this is the best God can do, I am not impressed. Results like these do not belong on the resume of a supreme being. This is the kind of shit you'd expect from an office temp with a bad attitude. Just between you and me, in between you and me, in any decently run universe, this guy would have been out on his all-powerful ass a long time ago. And by the way, I say this guy because I firmly believe, looking at these results, that if there is a God, it has to be a man. No woman could or would ever fuck things up like this. If there is a God, if there is, I think most reasonable people might agree that he's at least incompetent and maybe, just maybe, doesn't give a shit. Doesn't give a shit, which I admire in a person and which would explain a lot of these bad results. So rather than be just another mindless religious robot, mindlessly and aimlessly and blindly believing that all of this is in the hands of some spooky, incompetent father figure who doesn't give a shit, I decided to look around for something else to worship. Something I could really count on. And immediately, I thought of the sun. Happened like that. Overnight, I became a sun worshiper. Well, not overnight. You can't see the sun at night. First thing the next morning, I became a sun worshiper. Several reasons. First of all, I can see the sun.
Okay.
Unlike some other gods I could mention, I can actually see the sun. I'm big on that. If I can see something, I don't know, kind of helps the credibility along, you know? So every day I can see the sun as it gives me everything I need. Heat, light, food, flowers in the park, reflections on the lake. An occasional skin cancer, but hey, at least there are no crucifixions, and we're not setting people on fire simply because they don't agree with us. Sun worship is fairly simple. There's no mystery, no miracles, no pageantry, no one asks for money, there are no songs to learn, and we don't have a special building where we all gather once a week to compare clothing. And the best thing about the sun, it never tells me I'm unworthy. Doesn't tell me I'm a bad person who needs to be saved. Hasn't said an unkind word. Treats me fine. So, I worship the sun. But I don't pray to the sun. Know why? I wouldn't presume on our friendship. It's not polite. I've often thought people treat God rather rudely, don't you? Asking, you know, trillions and trillions of prayers every day. Asking and pleading and begging for favors. Do this, give me that, I need a new car, I want a better job. And most of this praying takes place on Sunday, his day off. It's not nice, and it's no way to treat a friend. But people do pray, and they pray for a lot of different things. You know, your sister needs an operation on her crotch. Your brother was arrested for defecating in a mall. But most of all, you'd really like to fuck that hot little redhead down at the convenience store. You know, the one with the eye patch and the club foot. Can you pray for that? I think you'd have to. And I say, fine, pray for anything you want. Pray for anything. But what about the divine plan? Remember that? The divine plan. Long time ago, God made a divine plan. Gave it a lot of thought, decided it was a good plan, put it into practice. And for billions and billions of years, the divine plan has been doing just fine. Now you come along and pray for something. Well, suppose the thing you want isn't in God's divine plan. What do you want him to do? Change his plan? Just for you? Doesn't it seem a little arrogant? It's a divine plan. What's the use of being God if every rundown schmuck with a $2 prayer book can come along and fuck up your plan? And here's something else, another problem you might have. Suppose your prayers aren't answered. What do you say? Well, it's God's will. Thy will be done. Fine, but if it's God's will and he's going to do what he wants to anyway, why the fuck bother praying in the first place? Seems like a big waste of time to me. Couldn't you just skip the praying part and go right to his will? It's all very confusing. So to get around a lot of this, I decided to worship the sun. But, as I said, I don't pray to the sun. You know who I pray to? Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci. two reasons. First of all, I think he's a good actor, okay? To me, that counts. Second, he looks like a guy who can get things done. Joe Pesci doesn't fuck around. In fact, Joe Pesci came through on a couple of things that God was having trouble with. For years, I asked God to do something about my noisy neighbor with the barking dog. Joe Pesci straightened that cocksucker out with one visit. It's amazing what you can accomplish with a simple baseball bat. So I've been praying to Joe for about a year now. And I noticed something. I noticed that all the prayers I used to offer to God and all the prayers I now offer to Joe Pesci are being answered at about the same 50% rate. Half the time I get what I want, half the time I don't. Same as God, 50-50. Same as the four-leaf clover and the horseshoe, the wishing well and the rabbit's foot. Same as the mojo man. Same as the voodoo lady who tells you your fortune by squeezing the goat's testicles. It's all the same, 50-50. So just pick your superstition, sit back, make a wish, and enjoy yourself. And for those of you who look to the Bible for moral lessons and literary qualities, I might suggest a couple of other stories for you. You might want to look at The Three Little Pigs. That's a good one. That's a nice, happy ending. I'm sure you'll like that. Then there's Little Red Riding Hood, although it does have that X-rated part where the big bad wolf actually eats the grandmother, which I didn't care for, by the way. And finally, I've often always drawn a great deal of moral comfort from Humpty Dumpty. The part I like the best, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's because there is no Humpty Dumpty and there is no God. None, not one, no God, never was. In fact, I'm gonna put it this way. If there is a God, may he strike this audience dead. See, nothing happened. Nothing happened. Everybody's okay. All right? Tell you what. I'll raise the stakes a little bit. If there is a God, may he strike me dead. See, nothing happened. Oh, wait, got a little cramp in my leg. And my balls hurt. Plus, I'm blind. Oh, now I'm okay again. Must have been Joe Pesci, huh? God bless Joe Pesci. Thank you all very much. Joe bless you. Thank you very much.
So Scott. comment on George Carlin. Of course, you know, he's a humorist and he's going for jokes and he's certainly great at that.
Yeah, I you have to say, first of all, he's funny and he has much truth to tell. But I'm in the business of interviewing really, really smart people, and the one great truth about them is that they think they know more than they really do, whatever their name or whatever field they're in. He's got it half right. I understand his point of view, but he leaps to the conclusion that there can't be anything beyond his little concept of what religion is about. And, you know, if he were still around, maybe he's advanced on the other side, who's to say, but the spiritual world is a fantastically interesting place, and the way he wants to characterize it, of course, sounds silly, and it is silly, but I think most of your enlightened listeners realize that that's a little tiny part of what religion is.
I certainly hope so. And, you know, we do things in humor, and I start my show with satire, and I hope I don't offend people, but I know I do occasionally. But, you know, it's just trying to be humorous. But let's be serious for a minute. As I'm talking with Scott Smith, author of God Reconsidered, and I want to get on the subject of the Vedanta, the thing about the idea of being a part of Brahman or God, because that to me that resonates. What is your take on it? I think you.
Well, yeah. Again, everybody's free to disagree with me, but I've thought about this carefully, and I've talked to a lot of Hindus about it. This is not mainstream Hinduism. This is a type of Hinduism, Advaita Vedanta, which became popular because the gurus in the 19th century, early 20th century came forth and taught it. But I have no problem with the notion that we are part of Brahman or the One. But the notion that we have no personal existence, that we are, that all we need to do, as Shankara taught, is to recognize that we don't have individual existence, that we're basically a figment of Brahman's imagination, I think this clashes with the evidence for individual spirit. So that's the bone I have to pick. And I go into quite a bit of detail in the chapter on that part of Hinduism. But mainstream Hinduism, which is very shamanistic, I think has a lot of truth to it. And if I had to embrace a religion other than Gnostic Christianity, it would be the mainstream Hindu version. But what I'm talking about with Advaita Vedanta, the Shankara part, has to do with a very intellectualized philosophical minority. It's probably 5% of Indians believe in that.
Well, you know, I'm right now, not at this moment, but at this moment I'm doing the show, but I have a book on mitochondria, of all things, and I'm interested in getting into one of the chapters. One of the chapters says that it's going to tell us, or the chapter will tell us, why we have individuality. It apparently has to do with mitochondria, but why not? I mean, you know. It's part of life, part of the universe.
Yes, you should embrace all scientific discoveries without jumping to radical conclusions. And the irony is that people like Stephen Hawking are eager to believe that there are 10 unproven dimensions to the superstring universe, but God forbid that we should believe that there is an unseen world out there. So mitochondria and quasars and all the other strange, the universe is much, much stranger than any of us are recognizing, no matter what our philosophical position is.
One of the recent things I believe, that the quantum physicists have discovered or exposed is the how things are so connected, and how information is like instant, like across light years, is instantaneously there. So that, I mean, to me, it doesn't explain a lot, but it kind of hints towards an explanation, at least for me, of things like ESP and how that stuff can be, you know. If you need to have scientific data.
Yeah, I would say, incidentally, that if you want a list of scientists who believe in a great intelligence behind the order of the universe, an impersonal God, if you will, the list of the fathers of quantum physics will provide you with many of the great names, starting with Einstein. A lot of people think he was some kind of atheist or something, but the founding fathers of quantum physics were all believers in a great intelligence behind the universe, because the more they looked into quantum physics, the stranger reality turned out to be.
Well, we did earlier. We listened to just part of the Russell Brand rant from his little thing called True's News. But it was on God and atheism, and later in what he said, he was, I think he brought up some of those scientists that you're referring to right now, and how could you not think that there is a God because of all these incredibly scientific things. I wish I were not expressing it very well, but things that could have only, you know, this can only be because it happened at this exact second, and this can only happen, you know. It certainly lends towards a belief in, if you want to say, a higher power. Yeah, this is another thing, Scott, maybe we'll end on this, and that is the the vocabulary of this. It just doesn't work. You know, high God, him, higher power, anthropomorphic. Most cultures have an anthropomorphic God, but does it have to, we have to think of God that way? You know.
Well, I think that everybody should find out more about the spiritual world and pick their path. This notion that it's the primitive believers over here and the rational people like Stephen Fry in the other corner is a silly and unfair characterization. The world in its greatest sense, including all these other realities, is something that we're only just beginning to understand. And 100 years from now, we're going to have a greater appreciation of what reality is all about. And it's going to be very different from what we little mortals with our small minds understand right now.
Well, we have been talking with Scott Smith, Scott S. Smith, author of God Reconsidered. You've been listening to Sabino Veritas, which is heard every Thursday, 8 p.m. Pacific time, and all the other times around the world. You can get it there. Where are you getting it now? At 148.ca/1. You can listen to the archive shows at JuicedTalk.com. Next week, we're going to be looking at the Shawshank Redemption. But thank you for being with us, and I want to thank our guest, Scott Smith.
By George, he's got it! It is the end!